Welcome, everybody, to this much awaited Interintellect Salon with Peter Turchin, who I think grew so tired of my emails throughout the years that he thought that the only way to stop them from coming is if he comes and joins us for an Interintellect Salon. I think, as many of you, I also got acquainted more deeply with Peter's work during the pandemic. When it went from being a very exciting theory through which to meditate on, in my case, my Eastern European historical background and why certain things happened the way they happened. And it went into an area of prediction when we became curious whether if someone was able to predict all these black swan events happening, what else he might know about the future and how can we tease that out of him. So I'm sure that since then, Peter, you have participated in so many conversations where people are trying to tease these predictions out of you, whether that's for buying a house or investing in the stock market or hiding the family jewelry. We all have all these worries and questions about how to make better decisions. My angle and my query here is less about the stock market. If somebody's interested in that, be my guest. There will be no way of stopping you. But this is more about trying to understand a little bit the bigger picture. Clearly, we live in a moment when so many small things are very big and so many big things are very small. So if you accept my framing, then today we will mostly talk about clusters and scale. Does that sound good for everybody? Peter, to kick off, do you maybe want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Vienna, just so we understand this really interesting arc? I'm sure people who signed up for the salon and read my introduction are somewhat familiar with your journey, where, like Darwin, you started with the little creatures, and at some point you became very interested in this big ape that we are, doing all these wild things with our economies, with our private lives, with our religions, and you left the insect world behind to dedicate yourself to studying us humans. Now it's a global effort. What are you working on these days, and why are you in beautiful Vienna?
Well, I'm in Vienna because the Austrian state is enlightened enough to support really breakthrough science, and science that is not obvious how it will be used in practical terms. Even though we all know that science eventually always results in some ways that improve human, existence. Anyway, so about 8 years ago, Stefan Turner, who is the president of this institute, started what we call Complexity Science Hub. So it's a location where many different types of scientists can gather together. He offered me to lead one of the research groups, and that's what I do. My research group is called Social Complexity and Collapse, and we investigate two very, very big questions. One of them, how come, you know, if you think about it, human species is about, roughly speaking, 200,000 years old, all right? And for 95% of our evolutionary history, we lived in small-scale societies, maybe foraging bands of 50 people and gathering in ethno-linguistic groups of some hundreds, right? And then suddenly, over the past 10,000 years, the scale and complexity of our societies literally exploded astronomically by many orders of magnitude. So the question is, why did large-scale complex societies organize the states, which only appeared about 5,000 years ago? Now they've taken over the Earth, and nearly everybody, except for maybe some people in the Amazon forest, who live now within such state-level societies. So that's question number one. And the question number two is that we observe by looking at big data that our wonderful complex societies get into trouble recurrently every 200-300 years or so. And that has been so far, it has been pretty inevitable. So the question is, this is what my book is about, End Times. So why do these periods of social disturbance, political disintegration and violence, why do they inevitably come or have inevitably come? So that's the second question that we have been studying. And just let me add a few words that our approach, it's called Clio Dynamics. It's Clio is the muse of history in Greek mythology, and dynamics is the science of change. So we are interested in studying why societies changed, first of all, evolved to scale and complexity, and then why do we have this periodic breakdown episodes. And our approach is very scientific. We are not really historians, but we love history, and we use historians, the data that historians have collected. But our approach is that we first translate verbal theories into mathematical or computational models. Because when we deal with complex systems like human society, you cannot use your unaided brain to connect premises of theories to predictions. You have to do it by means of mathematical or computational models. So that's the first step. The next step, we gather big databases. And then the third step, we use analytical methods to test predictions from different theories using those data.
How do historians view you? I feel like whenever we encounter your work, there are two great taboos we immediately bump into with regard to Peter Turchin, right? So first you blow our minds, and then we bump into these two walls. One of the walls is viewing history as science. I would love to hear whether there is somewhere a group therapy for historians where they just talk about you and they try to process this since your 2006 paper. And the other thing is actually related to that, which is your quite well-proven theory that all these complex societies that you also write about in your book that just came out yesterday, right, about the Holocene evolution, that all complexification is a kind of result of violence. And who gets to deal well with violence? Who learns what from in the aftermath of violence, from establishing stronger institutions, strengthening the middle class, whatever other changes happening? So my first question would definitely be, just generally, have historians warmed to you since in the past 20 years? Do you receive less writing on the with lipstick on your bathroom mirror left there for you to be scared of them, or is it still an ongoing war? And the other question is, I mean, in the past 5 years since the pandemic, we have re-entered an era of wars. Have you updated any of your notions about it? Are we still learning from our wars?
Yes, this is a big, complex question. So let me start trying to answer it in steps. First of all, let's talk about the relationship between Clio Dynamics and history. When I started nearly 30 years ago, in 1997, in fact, that's when I decided to go this route and switch from studying biological systems. I've been trained as a complexity scientist, all right? But initially, I applied those tools to studying the dynamics of animal populations, insects, mice, deer, and many others. So when I decided to switch into what has become Clio Dynamics, I expected that most historians would be fairly negative. And I was pleasantly surprised. Yes, there is still a vocal minority, but it's not huge, who really hate what we do. And I encounter them sometimes in person, more often on Twitter, which allows them to vent. But they are decidedly a small minority. And balanced by that, there is a fairly large minority at the other end of the spectrum who are very supportive. Without them, in fact, we would not be able to do what we do, because we have more than 200 historians who have been helping us gather a database. It's called SESHAT, Seshat is the name of Egyptian deity of scribing and also record keeping. And so Seshat Global History Data Bank can only could only exist, first of all, thanks to the monumental work of thousands of historians, starting from Herodotus, actually, all right, who have gathered the necessary data. Secondly, we are very thankful to the more recent development of digital humanities and digital history, in particular, which resulted in the migration of knowledge to to computer readable situation. But also there are many questions that we need expert judgment on when we want to not every kind of datum variable that we study needs that. For example, it's fairly conceptually it's fairly easy to determine whether this particular society knew iron metallurgy, because we start finding many implements and weapons made from iron and steel. But there are many other questions we are interested in, such as what did people believe back 2,000 years ago or whatever. And for those very tough questions, we need expert opinions. And so we've been very lucky to have literally hundreds at this point historians who have been helping us with it. And by the way, if we look at the core group that does Seshat, then we have two of us are historians, one archaeologist, two archaeologists, one anthropologist, and myself, complexity scientist. Right, to finish with this part of the question, those both people, historians who hate us and those who love us, they are minorities. In the middle, there is a pretty large group who are fairly indifferent. And that's also fine. I mean, because they love them all, including the critics, because they are producing the necessary knowledge. And after all, Cleodynamics is not a dollar bill. It doesn't have to be universally liked. Okay, so your next question, remind me, Anna, what was your next question?
But actually I have a little follow-up to this, which is, you talk so much about the inevitability of things, right? And we will talk a little bit about free will in the second half of the salon. And so, every time I read you, I wonder, was it inevitable that with better data science, better computation, eventually we would turn into, you have a lot of Asimov references in War and Peace and War. And, is this inevitable that history would turn into a computation project eventually? And you just happened to be the person who had to do it, like somebody had to do it?
Well, my thinking about it is that I think it's useful to keep distinction between history as humanities, which is, of course, 99.9% of what happens today. And as I say, it's extremely valuable exercise. By the way, I'm very much supportive for training more historians and funding history, traditional history. We really need that. Right. And then keeping Cleodynamics, which is history as science, somewhat separate, because, many historians might feel threatened by us, but they should not be. Right. In fact, I'm hoping that Cleodynamics will actually help to increase funding for history. So in my view, it is useful to keep those disciplines, even though there is close connection, interconnection, right? But to keep them as separate, because they require very different types of training, for example. To be a cleodynamicist, I don't need to be able to read old Iranian, all right? But in order, if you want to study the Achaemenid Empire, then you have to have a variety of skills that are very specialized.
Mm-hmm. I recall Paul Hoffman writes this about his in his book about Erdős, that there are young mathematical prodigies and young musical prodigies because the rules are quite simple, but there are no young historians. You need to put in the decades and learn all the Iranian and read all the books and accumulate all the data to start being able to infer patterns and generally orient yourself. The second part of my question related to the question of war. As we will bring up inevitability, obviously, I mean, the first thing I did on ChatGPT was ran a simulation model for counterfactuals of how to de-escalate from the breaking out of the First World War. Like, was there one event that could have been removed? And what you learn is that no, right? It becomes this real tide in the affairs of man where, but what is the point where it becomes inevitable? I mean, one of the things that you first kind of ruffled feathers with was you're proving that wars are what make us democratic, egalitarian, artistic, good, complex, and functioning. And I'm quite curious whether the past 5 years may have changed your views on this as we are re-entering, or is it just proving your point? And you're like, yeah, I said that would happen.
First of all, let me say that I abhor war, and I look forward to that period in human existence when we will be able to abolish them, because their wars are not inevitable in my view, because if you think about it. If you go, let's go back 10,000 years ago, soon after the start of agriculture, when people started settling down, everybody lived in small-scale societies, a few hundred, maybe low thousands of individuals, and war was endemic. The reason war was endemic was because there was no overarching authority to stop war. So if one group decides to become violent, all right, or both simultaneously, it's very easy for violence to spread via the spiral of revenge and counter revenge. There was nothing that would prevent them, one village, from warring against the other village. But over the past 10,000 years, what happened was that the scale of our cooperation has increased dramatically. And so now, in functioning states, villages don't fight using lethal force. All right. So we obviously have not been able to make the final step. All right. So we have United Nations. United Nations is not powerful enough to suppress wars. But on the other hand, we are still very young as a as a species, in the sense that we this whole trajectory has happened over the past 10,000 years, and so hopefully it will not be another 10,000 years before we solve how to suppress wars. Now, the second part of this question is, what is the role of warfare in social evolution? What's very important is that the theory. Let me step back. So we started gathering data on evolution of human societies in 2011, actually. And by 2018, we've gathered enough, so we started publishing articles. And the key article that came out was in 2022, where we tested 17 special hypotheses belonging to five general classes of theories about what are the drivers for this increased scale and complexity of our societies. All right, and what turned out was that two classes were important. The other three that many people thought would be important, they actually were not supported by data. So this is how we actually reject some theories in favor of others. And the two classes of theories, one of them was not terribly surprising, that the role of agriculture. But the second one was surprising, the role of warfare. But it is not warfare that we focus on. It's not the killing of people. This theory actually comes from the new discipline of cultural evolution, It's called multi-level, cultural multi-level selection. And the logic is this. We want to understand why did people learn to cooperate at large scale in very big societies. We are actually humans are unique in the animal world because we cooperate in huge societies of millions and more of genetically unrelated individuals. So unlike ants or bees, for example. So cooperation is a seriously difficult problem because cooperation produces public goods that are shared equally, but it requires private contributions, sacrifice. And so it is very easily unraveled if people start behaving selfishly, which is known as free riding. All right. So it's a huge, a theoretical problem that has not been, that's still controversial. So cultural multi-level selection allows us to simultaneously include in our model both the forces acting at the individual level that prompt us to defect and to free ride, but also the forces acting at the group level, which actually promote behaviors that help groups to become more cohesive, more cooperative, and so on and so forth. And so we actually can define mathematical models of this and show under what conditions the force, one force will overwhelm the other, under what conditions cooperation will evolve, and under what conditions it will actually unravel. So the important, one of the key forces that allows human societies to evolve internally cooperative structures is competition between different groups, between different societies and other human collectives. Because the logic is very simple. It was enunciated by Charles Darwin, 200 years ago. And that is that those groups who lack cooperation, they lose in competition with those groups who are internally cohesive. All right. Now, this competition does not need to be warfare. There are many examples of this logic operating without any violence. Right. Well, my favorite example is the competition of firms in the marketplace. Now, it's those firms that just cannot perform well. They go belly up and disappear. And as a result of that, we have continuous increasing of efficiency, of productivity, so on and so forth. Now, notice that if you think about it, this actually nonviolent competition amongst the firms, that's actually fairly recent. If you cast your mind back to the days of the East Indian Company and so on, East Indian Company was a business, right, proposition, but they had tons of warships and they were not above, shelling their competitors. So, gradually, the latest thing I can remember, because I grew up in the Soviet Union, I left in 1977, but I was reading about the 1990s. Their competition between businesses was very cutthroat, literally speaking. I mean, they were hiring killers, assassins, to kill the opposition. And now you may think what you want about modern Russia, but that is all gone. So other examples is, I'm a scientist. It is competition between scientific schools and proponents of different theories, right? Unfortunately, sometimes this competition gets into infighting, but I am very much for keeping people out of it, and you need to fight ideas And some ideas need to be killed because they're wrong, right? And of course, that doesn't mean that their proponents need to be beaten up or anything like that. So just, sorry, I'm a little bit, talking maybe too much, but essentially my hope is that the humanity will evolve to the point where competition between societies will be using nonviolent methods. And now, just to give you an example of nonviolent competition, again, using the USSR. USSR was not an evil state. I grew up, it was normal childhood and everything, but it lost in competition. It lost in the competition economically, it lost in the competition ideologically. And so it, as a result, many of the more successful traits like some degree of free market, and so on and so forth, has been adopted. So that is an example that we can look toward. But of course, it is not, I mean, I can also acknowledge that it's going to be very difficult for us to stop wars because, as Reagan once said to Gorbachev, I think, that, if you want the USSR and USA to cooperate, you have to be attacked by Martians, right? Well, unfortunately, that only moves the scale of conflict to extraterrestrial level. No, we need to figure out how to compete, how to compete in nonviolent ways.
I hope you're right. You're often right. So there's some hope there for me. I have two more questions, dear audience, and then we will open the floor for audience questions and just raise your hand or share in the chat and we will read it out. I'm obsessed with social contract theory and especially how social contracts change across history and why. I'm also from Eastern Europe. I now live in America. Previously, I lived in Western Europe. Through my life, I've observed in a very Leonard Cohen way the empires rising and falling, various social contracts suddenly feeling obvious to people and not remembering that 5 minutes ago they were thinking something completely different. So this amnesia and renewal. And every once in a while in your work, this question pops up. Epidemics, kind of reshuffling the board, changing the expectations and commitments of people, freeloading, what counts as freeloading suddenly changes. Wars, obviously, another great example. But what makes this so poignant in your writing to me is, to me, this is where my question of free will comes into play. I would think that kind of to the opposite of your theory would be the great man theory, where everything is agentic libertarianism and man against the determinism, suddenly shifting it all. But the social contract theory might be where the two theories overlap, because somebody has to propose the social contract, right? Whenever there is a breaking point, if it hadn't been FDR proposing his version of the renewal of the social contract, maybe another person would have proposed something else in that moment of softness where people are open to that. If it hadn't been Hitler, I would imagine somebody a little bit milder, it would have been a much more benign new social contract that people would still have accepted in that moment. Also, some social contract proposals are very explicit, right? Somebody like literally shouting on a pulpit and broadcast on the wireless. And some are very sneaky, right? Like there's a great theory by my former professor, Peter Gyurd, that in 1957, Kádár in Hungary changed the social contract by saying, we will not bother you about what you did during the Holocaust. If you don't bother us, what we did in 1956, kind of stomping on the revolution. And people implicitly accepted this. They started the televised service. Television appears in Hungary in 1957, and the social contract is sealed, but it's never explicit. So I'm quite curious whether I am correct in assuming that a little bit of the great man theory of the agenticism can creep into your system of deterministic viewing the world, and is it related to the social contract?
Well, our thinking, first of all, is far from deterministic. So in particular, then what we would like to do next is to do what we call multi-path forecasting, because future cannot be predicted perfectly. And that's, by the way, maybe let me just say a few words that, about prediction. All right, because we use prediction in a very special scientific way. The prediction is the way to test theories against each other. We want to find out which theories better describe the workings of our societies. And how do you do that? You extract predictions from those theories, and they will make different predictions because they are different theories. And then we gather data to find out which theories, predictions are supported. So prediction here is a very subservient, even, I would say, plays a very servile role. Now, prediction, in that way, the forecast I published in 2010 about the United States, that was a scientific prediction. It was specifically derived from structural demographic theory. It identified what are the driving forces are, and I didn't know that it, whether it would be true or not. All right, so now we're doing the same thing. We're finishing an article about Japan. And also, we will make predictions about the next 10 to 25 years. And we want to repeat this more often. And I'm sure that many of our predictions will be wrong, right? But that's the, the heart of science is learning from wrong predictions. Okay, so that's so let me deal next with the role of big men or big persons or whatever. It is, and to make those predictions, it's we have to do this multipath forecasting means that it's just like, you know, you've seen those prediction of hurricanes, right? Here's the hurricane and there is a whole, suite of possible trajectories. And so we do the same thing. Right, we are trying to see
the meteorology of human events.
Well, that's remember that our atmosphere is a very complex system, which is characterized by chaos, butterfly effect, and so on and so forth. And so are human societies. Right. Anyway, now back
to Robert Wiener here, who brings up the German children's songs to say that you can predict the planets, but not the clouds.
Well, yeah, that's right. Exactly. So Newtonian mechanics was a brilliant decision to choose a system that is highly predictable. And that's why physics gets, its undeserved reputation as a precise science. Because they were very clever in choosing easy questions to solve. Anyway, as you can see, I have no physics envy, actually. So the role of individual in history. Now, let's talk about the breakdown part, right? What it now looks like is that. The road into crisis, that's fairly predictable. It can be advanced or delayed by other factors, but at least so far in the past, because people did not understand the mechanisms, all societies eventually get into these end times. But what, sort of like a massive ball rolling down the valley, narrow valley, and so there is really one individual cannot even deflect it, and if you try to stop it, you just get rolled over. But once you get to the crisis, it's in the mouth of the valley, now you're on the cusp, and there are many, many different trajectories. So we published recently an article that there is no such thing as a typical crisis. Each crisis is unhappy in its own way. We are stealing a little bit from Leo Tolstoy's book, right? And that means that this huge unpredictability means that little nudge here or there can roll the ball either to complete collapse, real utter, disaster, or you can push it in a much more favorable thing. And so we actually are studying those cases where societies got to the cusp of crisis but did not fall into civil war or violent revolution or things like that. And that's where our working hypothesis is. That's where the role of individuals, leaders, and of course the groups they lead becomes quite critical. And our current, it's on our current research agenda, we are actually studying both successful and unsuccessful leaders and their movements during those periods going back to the Age of Revolutions, before that to the 17th century. The goal, we have some hypothesis, and the goal is to gather enough data to figure out, first of all, which groups were successful in acquiring and holding power, and which of those were successful then in turning their societies and leading them out of the woods.
This is super interesting. And also how, like, innovation, scientific innovation is another area where the deterministic idea breaks down, right? Because yes, of course, often the innovation of a certain object will lead to certain events just because of the availability and Chekhov's gun being on the stage. But when something gets invented, now you are in chaos, right? Like, why didn't the Romans have the Industrial Revolution, et cetera, et cetera? Why did the steam engine take us such a long time when in Alexandria and even earlier we understood the mechanisms? So to me, that's really interesting. Are you familiar with Norman Garmezy?
Norman, what's the last name?
Yeah, Garmezy. Norman Garmezy from Harvard. Mm-hmm. Very different, but I'm quite fascinated by his work. He observed the breakdown in problem children throughout the 20th century. And at first, in the first half of his career, he was at Harvard, he identified various things to be present at the same time to predict that a child will become a problem person. They will develop learning disabilities, they will fall behind in school, eventually fall out of school, and then will be unable to hold a job, probably ends up incarcerated, et cetera, et cetera. And being a true scientist, eventually he understood that his model is incomplete because he kept running into kids where all the parameters are present for them to fuck up, essentially, and they don't. And he was looking at his own research findings and realized that, oh my God, 25% of the children that I predict to be collapsing soon don't. And he completely scratched his entire research, his life's work, which I think is a very noble thing to do at that point, you know, in it, with his status, and restarted from, he went back to the drawing board and started researching what makes somebody not collapse. And he basically identified four things present. And then, of course, it becomes a very interesting question. Is it a genetic disposition? Is it the availability of mentors? Is it external, internal? Obviously, a kind of combination of the two. But in a micro way, he kind of had the same intuition. And that in some cases, not messing up is more interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the things resisting this extremely powerful force where human virtue, the strengths of relationships, cooperation, being at the right place in the right time, all of these things suddenly become so important.
Interesting. Yeah, that seems to be a pretty valid analogy. Yeah, because we are talking about society, we are at our end, we are talking about societies in trouble, right? And not all of them inevitably fall into a really bloody conflict.
Exactly. I lived in Belgium for 3 years, kind of involuntarily, but they are an exceptional example of basically civil war set up where two countries live together. They pretend the other doesn't exist. You're 20 kilometers outside Brussels, and Brussels doesn't show up on the list of nearest cities, even though it's the capital, because you're in the...
But they're not killing each other. That's the important
thing.
That's
the point.
Exactly. So it's a failed state. It's a failed state, really. But they are not killing each other. So that's progress.
I was there during the pandemic and nobody looted anything. I always joke that in the Game of Thrones set up, the house motto of Belgium is, we don't give a fuck. It's just they were completely chill about it. They don't care. Another thing that struck me so much, and I was just kind of chuckling about it. Another example of cultural differences that will become very important in this is your contrasting of monogamous cultures and polygamous ones, and how they obviously play a part in elite overproduction. If you have a lot of wives with a lot of legitimate heirs, then elite overproduction will be kind of like on steroids, and every fourth generation will kind of like wipe out the world order beforehand. Maybe this is a good moment to kind of drop in the fertility crisis here, which seems to be affecting the elites and countries with elite overproduction more strongly. Do you see some kind of dark solution in the fertility crisis to our current problems?
Which crisis?
The fertility crisis. The elite
Babies. yes.
What's your contrarian take?
Well, because I study human societies in the long run, I just don't see any crisis. I mean, human societies, human populations have been going up and down, and we've had infertility has been changing back and forth. You know, one baby bust that we have very good data on is the United States in 1930s. Before the baby boom, there was a baby bust. Another one is the 17th century England. We have very, very good data for them. And it was the falling fertility that resulted in population decline in the second half of the 17th century there. So many people, it's not like one-child policy, right? People do it voluntarily. So at the individual level, it's a question of choice, and that's fine. So we don't want to force people, right? That's one thing. The second thing, at the societal level, with people like Musk, Elon Musk, for example, they don't understand that there is a silver lining to the fertility, to the fallen fertility. And that is one way that in history, something that I call wealth pumps have been turned off. All right. So maybe I should just say, so wealth pump is the precursor to societies starting on the crisis, the path to crisis. It essentially is when this wealth pump is turned by, and it starts taking the affluence and wealth from the worker, the common people, and giving it to the elites, right? So now one way in history that wealth pumps were turned on, it was inadvertently, it was a Malthusian mechanism, just overpopulation. So this is what happened, let's say, in 17th century England and many, many times before. All right, so you have too many people, but not enough land to produce food or give them also, jobs. All right, too many workers, and so the price of labor goes down. All right, so this is quite obvious. So this situation resulted in a lot of popular immiseration. We see it, common people were becoming shorter because they didn't eat well enough, there were more diseases and things like that. But the elites were actually doing very well, right? So it was a transfer of wealth from the general population to the elites. And then during the second half of the 17th century in England, they had a very, violent period with the civil war and then a bunch of other events and so forth. But because conditions were so poor for common people, they started making fewer children. Specifically, the specific mechanism, I don't know if you want to go into those details, the specific mechanism was that cultural norm at that time was that a woman, before she could get married, she had to have enough dowry, right? And so most women had to run it. They basically by being the domestic servants and so on and so forth. So when their wages went down, it took them longer to earn a dowry. And they married later, and as a result, they had fewer children. Right, so, but what that did was that it actually it reversed the Malthusian mechanism. And at some point, this oversupply of labor disappeared, and then wages of workers started growing. A similar thing happened in the 14th century England also. After the Black Death, half of the population was gone, and there was not enough workers, and eventually it took like actually several decades, but wages of workers really shot up. So now back to the present. Of course, people like Elon Musk, he wants, I don't know if he actually realizes it, but he wants to have overproduction, oversupply of labor.
He's
because,
working on it personally, right?
Yeah, because
very, very
if you have oversupply of labor, you have, you know, like one of the capitalists back in 19th century. Actually, they were much more honest then. They say the same thing among themselves. I know it from first, you know, sources, but they don't say it publicly. But what that guy, the capitalist, said that I want to have a crowd of unemployed in front of my factory. So if any of my workers, you know, start making any demands, I kick them out and grab one of those guys. Right. So that's unfortunately the logic. I'm not saying that all capitalists are, you know, predatory human beings like this. I mean, there is a lot of variability. But as a class, right, it is in their interest to have more more people.
I always
right?
joke that every boss is a capitalist and every employee is a Marxist.
What will happen is, so here's my scenario. It's not. It's going to take a while, but this the decline in fertility will be naturally reversed when declining supply of labor results in increasing well-being of people. And then what will happen is that maybe some women decide not to work and devote themselves to children, you know, or, you know, there's a variety of ways. You know, you don't have to, if you earn enough money, you don't have to live with your parents. You can afford an apartment. I won't go into details, but essentially, this is how it has happened in the past. And I don't see why the future would be any different, because for the majority of humans, having children is a good thing. All right, and so because we've evolved that way, all right.
Maybe AI will complicate the labor market a little bit in this sense, but I don't see how it would not lead to increased well-being. Why can't we be the generation where we're like, oh, we don't have to work, you know, we don't have to just, all the salons are free, come enjoy. Guys, we are opening the floor for questions. Denise, I know you have to leave in a moment. Do you have any questions that you are eager to pop in just very quickly while you're still?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Anna. Great to see you. Peter, thank you. This is fantastic. You actually you started to sort of get there because I was curious. It seems as though your theory predominantly leads with a theory of social change versus economic change that then sort of precludes that social elite overproduction. And I was curious how, you know, I'm thinking of David Graeber's work and his emphasis on the role of debt in creating this widening inequality within societies, which naturally either has to resolve in some sort of debt jubilee or has to be resolved violently through mass redistribution of land and economic assets. And I'm curious if you how you see your work in contrast or in combination with that sort of more economic analysis as the frame or as the driving force for why societies reach this point of sort of, you know, needing to resolve in some sort of means, whether violent or not.
Yeah. There is a heterodox economist, I'm blinking,
Steve Keane.
He too, but no, I was thinking of the other guy who, you know, Hudson. Michael, sorry, not Steve. Michael Hudson.
Michael Hudson.
He's also has a, he actually wrote a several books about this. So the debt, and by the way, Michael Hudson is much more, I read the whole book, Debt, by Graeber. And I actually never understood what his theory is, because he keeps talking anyway of that. No bad words. So debt, or what Hudson calls FIRE, right? Financial, insurance, real estate, and whatever real estate. That's a form of it's a modern wealth pump. All right. So we the FIRE industries gets people to transfer a huge amount of wealth towards them, and this is quite old. So, for example, in early Roman Republic, one of the major issues between plebeians and the patricians was the issue of debt. And so, as Michael Hudson argues, wise societies, and he gives a lot of examples from Mesopotamia, which is where the Jubilee comes from. So wise rulers would, every 50 years or so, would periodically abolish this this thing. So that goes against one sector of the elite. So who are the losers? It's the FIRE, industries and their owners, right? Who are winners? Well, first of all, obviously, general population, but also rulers. Rulers are winners because they diffuse a huge bomb that can result in an explosion, right? So that's so here. I think I'll stop here, but just point out that wealth pump can be turned on in a variety of ways. We talked about the Malthusian, but it can also and has often been turned in the past by financialization. So today, for example, actually, the finance capitalism is, I agree with Michael Hudson, it's fairly parasitic, right? It's not really producing anything, but it's creating misery and also creating mass mobilization potential amongst people.
Could I ask one tiny follow-up? Yeah, thank you so much. I've actually co-authored two books on market concentration and capital flows. And it seems to me that one of the major modern sort of issues that we have is the truly global nature of the problem, where, as you say, finance capitalism now is totally unconstrained by any nation state's one ability to properly regulate. That's why we're looking at global wealth taxes and so on. But we don't have the commensurate kind of planetary scale governing institutions to deal with the ways in which now these dynamics are represented at a global scale. And I'm just curious if you've seen anything interesting, or you have any theories about ways in which you can constrain the wealth pump at the kind of global level versus, you know, at a kind of individual, more nation state level where it's happened in the past.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a huge controversy right now in France. The so-called Zucman tax, I'm sure you're quite familiar with it. And at the same time, there was recently an article, I forget where, which said that when Norway tried to increase their wealth tax, which Norway is, I think, one of the very few states that has a wealth tax, that it resulted in whatever 50 billionaires leaving, and actually I don't know what how true this whole thing is. Now, so I would say my approach is at two levels. First of all, it is, you know, if wealthy people leave, then it's not necessarily going to be such a disaster. I mean, how many of the entrepreneurs have actually managed to do it more than once? Very few. Steve Jobs was one of the few. Most of them, you know, they did it once. So they go and they live in Switzerland or Monaco and whatever, all right? They enjoy their ill-gotten gains. But did the society really suffer because of that? You know, that's a question I don't know empirical answer to, but I suspect it's not huge. Then Gabriel, for example, Gabriel Zucman, he says that, you know, he has a way to deal with it. So the exit taxes, right? You cannot just leave, right? Certainly, United States, for example, is very good at pursuing people, no matter where you live, right? And so, you know, here in Austria, for example, it was kind of hard to get a bank account. Because I'm American, right? So because United States requires you all kind of onerous things, right? And then of course, but eventually we will have to deal with it at the global level. I would say it will only take 3 or 4 countries to agree. If China, well, U.S., China, India, Russia, and European Union, right? So 5, they agree on this, then they can certainly make life hell for people who run away to even wherever, all right? So it is much easier, we know this from social science, that it's much easier to concert, the fewer major players you have, the easier it is to concert. Actually, if United States decided to do it, United States has enough power to enforce this globally, all right? So I think this, in principle, could be done. And I'm not a big proponent. I'm not saying that I'm a supporter of the wealth tax. I don't know, right? I'm not an economist. What I know is that we have to shut down the wealth pump. And there are many, many different mechanisms. One of them is the wealth tax. So we should definitely consider it and figure out how or whether we use it. But the goal is not to squeeze billionaires. The goal is to shut down the wealth pump.
Thank
Steve,
you.
It's good to see you.
Oh, you know each other.
Yes.
I'm so curious, Peter.
There's somebody with a raised hand.
Oh yeah, DJ, go.
Yeah, this is fantastic. Thanks for doing this. I'm just curious, you know, just as a casual reader of these kinds of things, I've read your book, I've read, you know, the Neil Howe books. I'm just curious to what degree, if any, what you write about is either agrees with or in conflict with kind of the turning, you know, the cycles of history hypothesis.
Yeah. So you're talking about Neil and Howe, right? Actually, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a year ago, I was in the same Zoom room with the one who survives. I guess that's Neil. I have actually, if you're interested, I have a blog post about it. All right, on my in my blog archives, so you can find it by searching my blog with Procrustean, the word Procrustean. So it's an interesting theory, and there is a lot of truth to it. Certainly, generational things are important. And they help us understand how societies, you know, the dynamics of societies. But I disagree with them about their 4 generational thing, because the evidence that we see, it's about 50-year cycle, and that suggests 2 generations, all right? I call it the fathers and sons cycle. I talk about it in a variety of my publications, such as War, Peace and War, and also End Times. All right. My critique to them is that they don't really throw the scientific approach at their theory, because the essence of testing theories with data is that you attempt to predict data that is not known to your theory. The Procrustean, remember Procrustes, who would cut you off a little bit, stretch you a little bit, right? The Procrustean approach is you do it the other way. You start with the theory, which you believe, and then you stretch or cut off the data until it fits. And that's what I'm afraid they're doing. I'm saying this with great respect for both of them. I'm not attacking them. I'm criticizing methodological approach, all right? So that's why I just don't see any evidence for the four-generation cycle. Now, one thing is that we agree upon is that we both made predictions about 2020s, all right? So that's a plus in both our theories. But I worry that I was just lucky, and that's why we are doing now Japan, France, and other places. But they tend to be, they tend to just enjoy being right for once.
Okay. Can I just do a quick follow-up on that? To what degree do you think, one thing they do say, they talk about how different countries have different cycles, right? But that they all pretty much aligned after World War II. And that's mm-hmm. when it sort of became a global cycle. Is your theory, so just leaving apart everything else they say, are the things you talk about, do you think it's pretty much global in nature, or is it localized to different countries?
Do you remember, it's been a while since I read them, do they think also China is part of that pattern?
I believe they do, because China was...
Okay, great. So we will know in 30 years, okay. If we live long enough. Okay, so China, the West, Western countries, specifically North America, Western Europe, and Australia, Japan, part of that, they are on similar trajectories. But there is substantial difference. So, for example, Germany is maybe 20 years behind United States, all right? And so that all gives us an opportunity to test theories more in a more refined way. Now, Russia and China are on opposite trajectories. Russia right now, as a result of this conflict with of the war in Ukraine, all right, it is actually living its own end times, which were 1990s and so on and so forth, and it's getting on a more internally cohesive and cooperative trajectory, because I read Russian, I can follow this very closely. China is even more interesting case. So China had its own end times. It was quite a long period, they call it the century of humiliation, from 1850 to 1960 or so. All right, so as soon as the cultural revolution was over, but particularly once Mao died, right, 1970s, they entered the integrative period. So they've been in that integrative period only for about 50 years, and they still have quite a distance to run. There are some problematic spots. So for example, they have an overproduction of credentialed youth. This seems to be quite serious, but they have controlled overproduction of wealth holders, because Xi Jinping essentially he just told billionaires that you make money but don't go into politics, right? So China has we are actually doing this study now. It's kind of hard to get data for China because they're pretty secretive. But in about a few months, we'll run the model and see whether my impression is correct. But my impression is that China has still a lot of legs before they get into their crisis. So once we publish this prediction, we wait and see which theory is correct. I think Stephen Dworkin has raised his hand.
Yes, thank you. This has been super interesting for me. I'm glad I just happened across it recently, but it coincides with a lot of things that I've been reading and someday hope to be able to write about. As you started, it reminded me of a couple of books that I read recently, and I apologize for not having prepared I can't remember the name of the author, about the collapse of civilization and how this thing that is generally feared has actually benefited people in many cases, or most cases, that people move, the cities fall apart, people move out to the countryside, they live a better life, and so on. And also then there are books like Dawn of Everything, which David Graeber also participated in, where they take a different view of the good image that the growth of civilization usually has, that and point out that in many ways people were better off before the creation of complex society. And I was wondering how these views of that, which go against kind of historical view of, you know, what's good for society, how that affects or brings some more interesting questions into your research.
Well, no, I disagree with that book. I actually criticized it. And in fact, David Graeber, when he was still alive, he wrote a bunch of nasty things about me because that was that's what he liked to do. He was, but anyway, I think that's all wrong because the life in the past was not quite so great. And first of all, if you want to go back to the past, we'll have to kill off somehow 99% of the humanity. All right. I assure you, it's not going to happen naturally. All right. So it becomes, you know, since hopefully you all agree that we're not going to do that. Right. So it becomes a, a fairly sterile exercise. But let's do it. So growth of technologies, of physical technologies and social technologies can be documented. And they have made the life of humans much better. So I'm actually very happy that my wife doesn't need to go once a week to the cold stream and beat the clothes, clothing there on the stones, all right? And there are many other nice things about technology that we enjoy that made our lives longer and healthier and much more fulfilling. I mean, so if you go back to, 10,000 years ago, we lose all the rich intellectual life that we enjoy now. There will be no novels, there will be no historians, no cleodynamics, no science, no dynamics. So this is all not serious. So what? But of course, civilization has also had its downsides. Everything has downsides. Technology, fire you can use to cook your meal, or you can burn people with it. All right. And same thing with technology. However, what I argue, and I think I can document that with data, is that every time technology has done something terrible for us, then humans figured out how to control it better. So think about fire, for example, right? And so the way forward is not to go back. The way forward is to deal with the problematic issues that result as side effects from technologies. And social technologies, think about it. Social technologies are very important. I mean, part of it is the democratic norms of governance, but also bureaucracy. You know, we might love to hate bureaucrats, but without bureaucracy, a society that has more than, roughly speaking, a few hundred thousand individuals will fall apart without bureaucracy. This is like a very iron law. So we don't want to abolish bureaucrats. We want to control them so they work for the benefit of all. And back to your what you started with. Yes. So what happened is that that our societies periodically get into this end times, right? And that is that's traumatic, and many people get killed, and so on and so forth. But without that, we would essentially have one huge despot ruling us all. Okay, because of the iron law of oligarchy, the people in power are always tempted to use their power to enrich themselves at the expense of everybody else. And the only reason we don't have, we don't live in such oppressive societies is because of two reasons. First of all, they get either overthrown internally or conquered externally. This is the essence of multi-level selection approach. Competition between societies is what keeps societies not only internally cooperative, but it also controls those despots and tyrants. So the trick, though, I would say, to figure out how to do this without getting people killed. Because, yes, after the time of troubles, we have a golden age of common people, typically. All right, because that's when the wealth pump is not operating. And then due to the iron law of oligarchy, the elites start turning on the wealth pump. And then during the typical golden ages that you read about in history books, they are actually gilded ages. This is when the elites are doing great. But of course, they are writing all the books and making all the movies and so on and so forth. But their general population is actually being immiserated. So so we need this periodic resets, maybe jubilees or whatever, but it would be, we need, as a human species, we need to figure out how to do it without violence.
Thank you.
I'm quite curious about the question of nihilism. You do touch upon Tainter a little bit.
The question of
Nihilism, the emotion.
Nihilism.
So we become a little bit like, violence doesn't come from nowhere, right? Like, you get into a violent situation because something in the perception of reality, in the our perception of justice and injustice, and generally our attachment to our material goods changes, right? And we either don't care about them and we're happy to sacrifice, or we are so scared for them that we want to defend them. Do you agree with Tainter on nihilism? Like, is this something that necessarily kicks in once we reach peak complexity, once we are removed enough from the elites, once we feel exploited enough? And if so, is this something that we can do something about?
Yeah, I actually know Joe Tainter. We ran into each other several times at meetings. We are right now working on an article using Sechat data to test his theory, and we already know that his theory is incorrect because it's not a complexity. Of course, there are. It's not social complexity that brings societies down. In fact, the social complexity of the right kind is what makes societies more resilient to this breaking, to these breakdowns. All right. Are you trying to say something? Okay.
No, I'm just so excited about this. I want to read it.
Yes, this article should be send me an email in a couple of months. You should have it by then. So,
what is Tainter using complexity as a stand-in for? Like, what is there really?
So once you read his, especially his, major book, Collapse of Complex Societies, he defines complexity in ways that we also do. But then by the time you get to the second half, he starts substituting terms. So, for example, in our structural demographic theory, elite overproduction plays an extremely important role. So when he talks about complexity, often he just talks about the number of officials. But that's not complexity. It's the it's elite overproduction, all right? So this is a long, and I should really write a review, but I'm waiting until we have the article to criticize him. But much of what he talks about, for example, he talks about all these temple buildings. We use church building and temple construction as one of the proxies for elite overproduction. It's a form of conspicuous consumption, right? The elites are just trying to show. I'll have to, I only see part of the thing, so I'll read it next. Anyway, but to finish this part of the answer, the many proxies that he uses as proxies for complexity actually are much better interpreted as proxies for elite overproduction. Let me read. There's actually quite a lot of
chips. I just love this sentence from End Times, where you basically say that history and crisis DB tells us that the credentialed precariat, or in the jargon of climate dynamics, a frustrated elite aspirant class, is the most dangerous class for social stability.
Absolutely.
So I really, really love this. And it's so interesting because one reads about this theory and you actually can reflect even on like micro events in your own life, when resources suddenly become scarce and who was your friend is now in some kind of competition between you, and then the whole system falls apart, right? I used to make rock bands in my 20s and they all fall apart because of elite overproduction. Like there's multiple musicians are good, or they all want to sleep with the singer, and the whole system falls apart.
Unfortunately, I'm too old. Because when I arrived in the United States in 1978 at the age of 20, right, I actually saw the last, the last years before things started to unravel. So I was, as a young person, I thought that, I was worried about competition, of course, and so on and so forth. But now I understand talking to postdocs yesterday here, and I said, my God, we thought that we had it bad. You guys are really suffering. So I'm not a very good person from my personal point of view to judge these things. But let me just say things. This, if you think about the most dangerous profession, at least in the Western world, is lawyers. You know, Robespierre was lawyer.
Ben Wang at a salon who wrote the book.
Lenin was lawyer. Abraham Lincoln was lawyer. Castro was lawyer, and so on and so forth. So in China, actually, it's the teaching profession, because Hong, who was the leader of the Taiping Rebellion, he was a teacher. And by the way, Mao was a teacher also. So there's some, but essentially, if you produce too many lawyers, then you are creating a problem. In the United States, we've been overproducing lawyers by a factor of 3 to 1 until AI. Now, AI is going to eat at least half of those jobs. So you'll have 6 times as many hungry lawyers. And lawyers are very dangerous because they're ambitious. Many of them are very smart. They are well, you know, connected. So they're good at organizing things.
And they paid a lot for their studies, so they want to make it back, right? They run after their sunk cost. Because there's also this thing in the US, how much you paid for your studies. And going to law
exactly.
is very expensive in time.
Exactly. So the worst possible situation, you have, you know, three quarters or five sixths of lawyers with like 200,000 debts, all right? And
if
nothing.
For 15
like Lenin said, proletariat has nothing to lose but its chains, right? But in reality, the educated precariat has nothing to lose but its debts.
It's incredible. Nevada, you have your hand up. Great to see you. Maybe we'll get a John Gray angle on this all.
Hello. Thank you all. This has been great. I had a question actually on AI, and you kind of started touching on it just a moment ago after I put my hand up. But yeah, I wanted to just know, what are your thoughts generally on the technology? Do you see it complicating your theory? Do you see it kind of hastening the wealth pump and wealth concentration? What are your thoughts just generally on artificial intelligence and how it relates to your general theory?
Yeah, well, see, this developments of AI are not the first time we had a lot of technological progress. So the previous period, which is Industrial Revolution, is very useful to look into. Industrial Revolution, though, happened fairly slowly, and so it was not there's a good study, a paper on this, because it was fairly slow. People, most of the skilled workers were not fired. It's just new workers were not hired. Now, but of course, you know, we can measure this. Technology is moving much faster today than 200 years ago. And so it will be a major disruption. So let me just say that I did have a blog called When AI Comes for the Elites, right? And by the way, I don't want to sort of do this, but we've been only talking for an hour and a half, but I have a pretty active Substack and like many years of archived blogs. So many of the questions that you might want to ask me, actually, I might have already answered them. But so, but back to your question. Okay, there are two things. First of all, there was initial hype. All right, and now there is a bit pulling back against. But I am completely convinced that AI will be replacing human workers. All right, and so the question is, if we don't, as a society, manage it, this will be this is already a huge disrupting factor, and it will be it will get worse. All right. The problem is that in the United States, and I have a whole chapter in my book End Times where I argue that United States is a plutocracy. All right. Now, unfortunately, our elites, both the economic and political, which is quite intermingled, they don't really care that much about common people. And therefore, I'm a little bit pessimistic whether AI will be controlled, will be shaped in ways that would benefit everybody rather than a small group of individuals. Because by its nature, it's you know, who has more money will have the most effect on using AI, and there is no guarantee that they will do it in favor of population as at large. So I am somewhat pessimistic.
Thank you so much. I think we probably agree with you that, especially if your model is correct, and why wouldn't it be, then wiping out half of the elite will cause its own problems. And also because it's a non-violent wiping out. I mean, we hope that AI will wipe out jobs and not actual people, at least in the first you know, part of the story. And a lot of people without a place in the world that they hoped for is a very, very dangerous situation. And my outro just for the last minute, are we learning Your model so deeply rests on the assumption that humans have these catastrophes, these clusters of negative events, things fall apart. And then we kind of learn and we usher in a new era of equality and flourishing. Are we currently learning or are we in a...
It's a cyclic process. So so during the these periods of instability, the elites get quite frightened. And so they either themselves implement things like FDR, right? My best example is the Tsar Alexander II, who said to the nobility that we'll either have reforms from above or revolution from below. All right. And then the next generation still remembers it, and two generations later, they forgot to turn on the wealth pump. That's one thing. So at the individual level, it's very easy to forget. But at the institutional level, we can document it. We have been, this is actually goes back to Joe Tainter's thing. All right. So we have been accumulating useful institutions. And as a result of this, statistically, it's a very strong pattern that collapses become much less profound, less bloody, and societies reconstitute themselves much faster. So that collective learning process is definitely ongoing.
Well, let's end on a hopeful note. Peter Durchin, thank you so much for joining us. We love your work. Please keep teaching us helping us predict and make better choices. And thank you, everybody, for joining. Excellent questions. Also, excellent questions in the Zoom. We will continue on our Discord. So if you're in the community at InterIntellect, you can share your thoughts there as well. And please follow Peter on Substack. A lot of the things that we touched upon so briefly, he already has elaborated on and also very prolific there. So I imagine that the pieces will keep continuing coming. Thank you, everybody, and have a lovely rest of your day or evening.
Great. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.